Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we are discussing the science of eyewitness testimonies. We like to think of human memory as a courthouse vault, a secure, climate-controlled space where the facts of our lives are filed away, untouched by time, waiting to be pulled out and read under oath. When a witness looks a jury in the eye and points across the courtroom with absolute, unwavering conviction, we're biologically and socially programmed to believe them. We equate confidence with proof. But cognitive biology tells a completely different story. Before we can use science to verify a story, we have to look at the physical, biological, and institutional noise that corrupts the data before it ever hits a laboratory folder. There's a distinct, high-stakes theater that happens in a courtroom when a prosecutor looks up at the witness and asks, "Is the person who did this in the room with us today?" The witness turns, locks eyes with the defendant, points a finger, and says with absolute, unwavering certainty, "That's him. I will never forget that face." For a jury, that moment is electric. It feels like the ultimate smoking gun. We are socially programmed to believe that a high level of confidence equals a high level of accuracy. If someone is willing to swear under oath with tears in their eyes that they are 100% certain, we believe them. But statistically and scientifically, that confidence is a dangerous illusion. The data from decades of exonerations tells a completely different story. According to the Innocence Project, mistaken eyewitness identifications contribute to approximately 70% of wrongful convictions overturned by post-conviction DNA testing. Many of those mistaken witnesses were just as certain, just as emotional, and just as confident as any juror could ever ask for. The core problem is that we suffer from a massive cultural misunderstanding of cognitive biology. We like to think of our brains as flawless, high-definition security cameras. We assume we record raw footage of an event exactly as it happens, store it away in a pristine digital vault, and then pull up that exact untouched file whenever we need to recount it. But the forensic reality is that the human brain is not a hard drive. Memory does not record. It reconstructs. It functions closer to a corrupted digital file that updates, alters, and saves over itself every single time you open it. Every time you recall an event, your brain doesn't just look at the data, it rewrites it. It injects your current emotional state, outside suggestions, media coverage, and internal biases into the original file, and then hits save. By the time a witness points a finger in a courtroom months or years later, they aren't reading from the original recording. They're reading a heavily edited version that their brain has finally accepted as the absolute truth. To understand how this data corruption happens in the real world, we can actually look to a classic 1990s courtroom comedy that is widely considered by defense attorneys and legal scholars to be one of the most accurate descriptions of trial law in cinema history. My Cousin Vinny. The movie works so well because it uses humor to perfectly illustrate the physical, biological, and environmental limits of human data inputs. In the film, two young men are on trial for a murder they didn't commit, and the prosecution's case relies almost entirely on three rock-solid, highly confident eyewitnesses. Vinnie Gambini's cross-examinations of these witnesses are essentially a masterclass in how to expose compromised data. First, let's look at the environmental limits through a witness named Mr. Tipton. On the stand, Mr. Tipton lays down an absolute, unshakable timeline. He swears he heard a gunshot, looked out his window, saw the two defendants get into a car and speed off. And that entire sequence took exactly 5 minutes because he was cooking breakfast. Vinny systematically dethrones this absolute timeline by looking at the physical chemistry of the breakfast itself, grits. Vinny establishes that no self-respecting Southerner uses instant grits, and regular grits take an unalterable 15 to 20 minutes to cook. By anchoring the timeline to the physical science rather than the human memory, Vinny proves Mr. Tipton's 5-minute clock is a biological impossibility. But Vinny doesn't stop at the timeline. He looks at the physical obstructions compromising the visual data input. He forces Mr. Tipton to admit that he was looking through a window with a dirty screen, set of rusted window bars, a dense row of trees, and a bush. The witness's visual intake was fundamentally blocked by environmental noise. Next, Vinny tackles the psychological limits of the human eye through an elderly witness, Mrs. Riley. Sitting on the stand, Mrs. Riley possesses absolute, unwavering certainty. She claims she saw the suspects clearly from her front porch, a distance of over 100 feet. Instead of calling her a liar, Vinny tests her biological hardware. He stands at the back of the courtroom, holds up a number of fingers, and asks her to identify them. She gets it completely wrong. Vinny demonstrates to the jury that Mrs. Riley's physical eyesight is profoundly compromised, and at the time of the crime, she was wearing the wrong prescription glasses. Her eyes physically could not resolve a clear image at that distance under those conditions. The ultimate takeaway from these cross-examinations is the exact core of our thesis. These witnesses weren't malicious. They weren't trying to lie. They weren't paid off by the state to frame two innocent kids. They genuinely, deeply believed their own narratives. What happened to them happens to eyewitnesses in real cases every single day. Their senses provided a poor, fragmented and obstructed data input, and instead of leaving a blank space, their brains automatically filled in the massive blanks to create a seamless, confident story. The brain craves a complete narrative, and it will happily manufacture one out of thin air just to make sense of the world. If you've ever scrolled through social media or sat on an intro to psychology course, you've probably seen some variation of a classic classroom prank. A professor is lecturing, and suddenly a person in a bizarre costume runs across the front of the room, steals a prop, and bolts out the door. The professor immediately stops the class and hands out a pop quiz, asking mundane questions about what everyone just witnessed. What color was the thief's jacket? Were they wearing a hat? What did they take? Inevitably, the vast majority of the room gets it completely wrong. Half the students will argue over a green jacket that was actually bright blue. The other half will look around in total shock, realizing they didn't even notice a theft occurred because they were too busy taking notes. We laugh at those videos, but in a forensic context, that exact gap in human data processing is terrifying. This phenomena is driven by a massive cognitive bottleneck known as inattentional blindness. The definitive data on this comes from a famous 1999 study by cognitive psychologists Daniel Simons and Christopher Chabris. In the experiment, they filmed two small groups of people passing basketballs, one group wearing white shirts and the other wearing black. They instructed research participants to watch the video and silently count the exact number of passes made by the team in the white shirts. It requires intense, active concentration. Right in the middle of the game, a person wearing a full, realistic gorilla suit walks dead into the center of the court, stops, faces the camera, thumps their chest, and calmly walks off. Gorillas on screen for a total of 9 seconds. The results were staggering. Roughly 50% of the participants missed the gorilla entirely. When researchers asked if they saw anything unusual, half the room said no. When told a gorilla had walked right through the frame, they accused the researchers of switching the videotape. The biological reality is that the human brain has an incredibly limited bandwidth for processing visual data. When you force it to focus intently on a specific variable, it actively drops massive pieces of environmental data without you ever realizing it. In criminal investigations, this translates directly to the weapon focus effect. If a victim or bystander has a loaded 45 caliber pistol pointed at their chest, their brain's entire processing power locks onto that weapon for survival. The brain drops peripheral data like height, weight, hair color, or facial structure. The witness isn't lying on the stand later. Their brain simply never logged the attacker's face because it was too busy logging the gun. Even when a witness is looking directly at a face, the brain's internal programming can still corrupt the data through the cross-racial identification deficit or own race bias. This is one of the most heavily documented and statistically validated phenomena in cognitive psychology. The data from archival legal studies is stark. Witnesses are up to 50% more likely to misidentify a suspect when looking at someone of a different race or ethnicity to than their own. In a simulated testing environment, a white witness is significantly more likely to misidentify a Black or Asian suspect, and vice versa. It's not a matter of racial animus, prejudice, or malice. It's a biological limitation based on a lack of perceptual familiarity. From infancy, the brain builds an internal structural template for facial recognition based on the demographic groups it interacts with most frequently. It learns to read highly subtle, unique structural nuances within that group. The exact spacing of the eyes, the slight curve of a jawline, the distinct ridge of a brow. When a person attempts to decode a face from an unfamiliar demographic, the brain's template fails to read those microvariables. Instead, it relies on broad surface-level generalizations. To the witness, the face looks distinct in the moment. But when they are forced to pick a face out of a lineup weeks later, the brain can no longer differentiate the subtle nuances, leading to massive rates of false identification. On the exact opposite side of the coin sits a psychological exploit you can find perfectly outlined in pop R&B history. Shaggy's song, "It Wasn't Me." In the song, a man gets caught red-handed by his partner. His friend's advice is to simply look her dead in the eye and say, "It wasn't me." Despite the fact that she saw him with her own two eyes. In real life, it sounds like an absurd, laughable defense strategy. But in a courtroom setting, weaponized absolute denial is an incredibly effective psychological tactic designed to exploit a vulnerability called the source monitoring error. Human beings don't just store the raw data of an event. We have to log the source of how we know it. Did I see that suspect under the street lamp? Or did I see his face on a mugshot in the news? Did I actually witness the muzzle flash? Or did my brain insert it later because I heard the bang? When a defense attorney or a gaslighting perpetrator aggressively pushes a counter-narrative with absolute conviction, they inject massive amounts of noise into the witness's source logging system. They don't need to disprove the physical evidence. They just need to get the witness to doubt their own biological hardware. Under an aggressive cross-examination, an attorney will drill into the environmental and psychological limits. "It was dark, wasn't it? You were terrified, right? You only saw him for 4 seconds? If the attorney delivers this with enough certainty, the witness's brain begins to fold under the pressure. The witness starts asking themselves, "Did I really see what I think I saw? Or is the stress altering my perception?" Once a defense attorney gets the eyewitness to hesitate on the stand, once they get them to shift from absolute statements to a compromised phrase like, "I think so," or "it looked like him," they have successfully weaponized the legal standard of reasonable doubt. They didn't have to change the facts, they just had to force the witness's brain to override its own confidence file. If a witness can easily drop a 9-second gorilla from their memory pool, or if a defense attorney can push a witness to completely doubt a crime they looked at with their own eyes last Tuesday, then what happens when you stretch those exact same cognitive vulnerabilities across months, years, or even decades? You land in the extreme end of memory contamination, repressed and implanted memories. This is our bridge into a territory where the line between fact and completely fabricated simulation vanishes entirely. We're going to do a massive deep dive episode on this later down the road, but you cannot talk about the volatility of eyewitness data without looking at how easily the brain can be coached into manufacturing an entire reality out of absolutely nothing. For decades, the legal and psychological systems operated under the dangerous assumption that the human mind was like an ancient burial ground. If you dig deep enough through the layers of trauma, you will eventually unearth an untouched, perfectly preserved truth. But Cognitive psychologist Elizabeth Loftus shattered that premise with her groundbreaking Lost in the Mall experiments in the 1990s. Loftus wanted to see if she could artificially engineer a highly specific childhood trauma in healthy adults. She recruited participants and presented them with a booklet containing four stories from their childhood. Three of the stories were completely real, provided by their actual family members. The fourth story was a total fabrication. The fake story claimed that when the participant was 5 years old, they got lost in a specific shopping mall, cried for an extended period, and were comforted by an elderly woman wearing a distinct outfit, and were ultimately reunited with their family. Loftus didn't just dump this fake story on them. She used highly suggestive pipeline. She had the participants' actual family members play along, subtly validating the fake event. Then, over multiple interviews, researchers used guided imagery and leading questions, encouraging the participants to try and remember the details. The results were a massive wake-up call to the forensic community. Roughly 25% of the participants fully accepted the fabricated event as absolute lived reality. But they didn't just say, "Oh, yeah, I guess that happened." Their brains did something much more terrifying. They began generating vivid, highly detailed additions to the lie. They started remembering the specific smell of the mall, the exact texture of the elderly woman's shirt, and the crushing feeling of panic they felt while lost. Loftus proved that you don't need a real event to create a highly emotional, unshakable memory. If you inject enough repetitive suggestion into a volatile cognitive environment, the brain will happily accept a completely fabricated file as a historical fact. This isn't just an abstract laboratory curiosity. This exact flaw in our cognitive hardware had catastrophic real-world consequences during the satanic panic of the 80s and 90s. The justice system was suddenly flooded with highly sensationalized, horrific legal cases built entirely on recovered or repressed memories. Well-meaning but profoundly misguided therapists and investigators used hypnosis, highly aggressive leading questions, and guided imagery on vulnerable adults and children. They were desperately hunting for hidden trauma. But they weren't digging up buried history. They were handing the human brain bricks and mortar, and the brain did exactly what it was designed to do. It happily built a wall. When a person in authority continuously asks, "Are you sure you don't remember a basement? Think harder. Could there have been candles? What did the robes look like?" The brain stops looking for a real file. It switches into simulation mode. It takes those suggestive bricks, mortars them together with real emotional stress, and creates a highly vivid, terrifying, completely fake memory. In a courtroom, an implanted memory doesn't look like a lie. The witness on the stand isn't acting. They are weeping genuine tears, experiencing genuine panic, and possessing absolute, unshakable certainty. To the jury, it looks like a slam dunk conviction, but forensically, it's pure fiction. It's the ultimate warning of what happens when we treat human memory as an absolute forensic anchor rather than what it actually is. Highly fragile, easily contaminated lead that must be verified by hard science. Stay tuned for the deep dive because the case files from that era are a chilling reminder of what happens when the justice system abandons the laboratory and starts chasing ghosts. But when we look at how bad data gets introduced into a criminal case, we have to talk about the mechanisms of the investigation itself. It is entirely possible for well-meaning investigators to inadvertently contaminate a witness's memory pool before the case ever reaches a courtroom. This usually happens during the identification process, where subtle shifts in structure and institutional pressure create a perfect storm for false certainty. The contamination often begins with how a lineup is physically structured. In most traditional investigations, police use a simultaneous lineup. This is the classic setup. Six individuals standing side by side behind a two-way mirror, or six mugshots laid out on a table simultaneously in a six-pack photo array. While this seems fair on the surface, it triggers a dangerous cognitive shift in the witness's brain. When a witness looks at the photos one at a time, they are forced to use absolute judgment. They have to look at a photo number one and ask their brain a binary question. Does this specific image match the raw data file in my memory? Yes or no? But when you lay out all six photos at the exact same time, the brain automatically switches to relative judgment. Instead of comparing the photos to their actual memory, the witness begins comparing the photos to each other. The question changes from, is the perpetrator here? To, which of these six people looks most like the perpetrator relative to the other five? This is where the system completely breaks down. If the actual perpetrator is not in that lineup, which happens frequently in active investigations, relative judgment ensures that the witness will almost always select the innocent filler who happens to look the closest to their fuzzy mental image. Once they point to that innocent person, their brain locks in the selection, overriding the original memory of the suspect with the face of the innocent filler. If a simultaneous lineup is a slow leak of bad data, a show-up is a catastrophic contamination event. The show-up occurs when the police apprehend a suspect near a crime scene shortly after the offense. Instead of taking the time to put together a structured, unbiased photo lineup back at the station, they drive the eyewitness over in the back of a squad car, shine a spotlight on the suspect, who is usually handcuffed, surrounded by uniform officer, and leaning against a police cruiser, then ask, is this the guy? Forensically, it's the ultimate form of memory contamination. The context itself is screaming the correct answer. The witness's brain is operating under massive adrenaline and stress. Instead of digging through a fuzzy, traumatic, low-light memory of the actual crime to find a face, the brain takes a lazy cognitive shortcut. It takes the highly crisp, vivid, high-contrast image of a person sitting in handcuffs under the police spotlight and completely overwrites the original degraded file. From that second forward, the witness is no longer remembering the criminal at the scene. They are remembering the man they saw in handcuffs. This vulnerability is supercharged by the inherent power dynamic between an everyday citizen and a law enforcement officer. It creates what psychologists call the authority feedback loop, and it operates on two distinct levels. The compliance trap, and the fear of backlash. First, look at the compliance trap. Human beings are evolutionarily programmed to look at authority figures for validation and direction. When a witness is sitting in a cramped detective bureau looking at a photo array, They aren't just looking at the pictures, they're hyper-analyzing the investigator. If an investigator has a hunch that a specific photo is their guy, they can easily give a subconscious wink and nudge without ever realizing they are doing it. It can be an expectant pause when the witness hovers over photo number three, leaning forward, or a subtle change in vocal tone. It can be an explicit, highly suggestive comment like, "Take a closer look at number three." Or, "Are you sure it's not the guy in the middle?" The witness instantly interprets these cues as hunting for a correct answer rather than the objective truth. When they pick the photo the detective wants, and the detective lets out a visible sigh of relief or says, "Great job, you picked our main suspect," a hit of dopamine floods the witness's brain. Their confidence is artificially inflated. They didn't just help solve a crime, they pleased an authority figure. The flip side of this loop is the fear of backlash. When an eyewitness looks at a lineup and says, "I don't think any of these guys were there," there is an immense psychological friction. The investigator's energy might shift to frustration, impatience, or disappointment. The witness feels like they're failing a test, being unhelpful, or wasting the police's time. To resolve that internal anxiety and appease the authority figure, the witness will actively compromise their own visual data. They will talk themselves into making an identification they aren't sure of, picking someone just to satisfy the room. Once again, this isn't about malice. It's about human compliance being treated as forensic proof. It highlights exactly why a human statement can never be the finish line of a case. If the investigative techniques actively distort the data before it ever hits a lab file, the system is just building a house of cards. Now, don't misunderstand the data here. The point of breaking down these psychological bottlenecks and systemic vulnerabilities isn't to argue that eyewitness testimony or confessions are completely worthless, or that we should just throw them out of the justice system entirely. They are invaluable tools. Many of history's most dangerous perpetrators were only caught because a regular person noticed something out of place and called it in. But we have to completely redefine how we treat that data. In a rigorous forensic investigation, an eyewitness account or a suspect statement is an invaluable lead generator. It's a starting point that dictates where to look, what to test, and who to interview. It is the beginning of the race, never the finish line. The catastrophic failure of the justice system occurs when an investigation treats a confident human narrative as a closed file, stopping the search before the hard science even begins. True modern forensic science rarely operates on a single cinematic smoking gun piece of evidence. Real cases aren't resolved by a perfect fingerprint left conveniently on a trigger, or a pristine strand of hair dropped neatly on a victim's lap. Instead, it's about the mosaic effect. Forensic methodology relies on layering multiple independent objective data points over one another until the cumulative margin of error shrinks to almost zero. You build a web of circumstantial but irrefutable data that completely removes human opinion from the equation. Think about how this plays out in a standard modern investigation. You might not have a clear-cut, high-definition video of a crime taking place, but you can build a flawless digital and physical web around a suspect's timeline. If a witness says they saw a dark sedan fleeing a scene, a stellar investigator doesn't just put out a bolo and call it a day. They tap into regional automated license plate readers, toll booth telemetry, and local business security feeds. They track the digital footprint of that vehicle, verifying if it was actually in the vicinity at that specific timestamp or if it was nowhere near the sector. If the suspect provides a verbal alibi, claiming that they were at home asleep across town when a homicide occurred, science can test the structural integrity of that story. Investigators pull cell site location information, mobile router connection logs, and even smart device health data. If the cell phone tower pings their device within a geographical sector spanning the crime scene at 2 a.m., or if their smartwatch logs a massive spike in heart rate and physical activity during the exact window they claim to be sleeping, the verbal narrative is scientifically dismantled. This brings us right back to the foundational principle of the laboratory mindset. A great investigator doesn't use forensics to look for confirmation bias. They don't take a witness statement and look only for pieces of science that back it up. Instead, they actively attempt to falsify the statement. They take the human data and try to use objective telemetry, trace evidence, and physics to disprove it. If a witness story survives every single scientific attempt to dismantle it, if the digital logs, the fiber matrices, the timelines, and the physical chemistry all align with the memory, only then does that narrative earn a high degree of credibility. But if the forensics contradict the memory, if the hard data stands in direct opposition to the human voice on the stand, then science wins every single time. Data doesn't get nervous under pressure. It doesn't want to please authority figures, and it never forgets its own source. In a case where memory was really important, in 1984, the Tampa Bay area was haunted by a ghost. A highly organized serial killer had spent months dropping bodies across 3 different jurisdictions. Local investigators were completely drowning in dead ends. Then, in the early morning hours of November 3rd, the monster intercepted 17-year-old Lisa McVeigh as she rode her bicycle home from a late shift at Krispy Kreme. The man who pulled her into that car was Bobby Joe Long. He had already murdered at least 10 women. Under the absolute terror of abduction, the human brain typically fragments. Panic sets in and memory logging fails. But Lisa's brain did something entirely spectacular. She consciously rejected the role of passive bystander to her own trauma. Blindfolded and trapped, she switched into an elite, hyper-focused state of survival telemetry. She chose to treat herself as a crime scene recorder. Lisa knew that human stories face heavy skepticism in the justice system, so she began planting physical anchors. When taken into his apartment, she purposefully touched the porcelain of the toilet, the smooth glass of the bathroom mirror, and the structural molding of the walls. She deliberately left her fingerprints all over his space, ensuring that if she didn't survive, she would leave a forensic trail directly to his door. She counted the physical steps he made her walk, exactly 19 steps up to his apartment. She memorized the deep texture of his carpet, noted the unique smells of his regular driving routes, and calculated the exact time intervals of his car rides. When the car stopped, she heard the distinct rhythmic mechanical sounds of an ATM transaction. He didn't just log data, he analyzed her captor. By deliberately building rapport and emotionally manipulating his massive ego, Lisa convinced him to release her alive after 26 grueling hours. Then, when Lisa finally escaped and presented this masterclass in data collection to the police, she wasn't met with open arms. She was met with profound skepticism. The investigators fell directly into a behavioral bias trap. They expected a victim to fit a specific, passive stereotype. Hysterical, fragmented, and broken. Because Lisa was calm, articulate, and handed them a highly structured, chronological data set, the police assumed she was making it up. They actually weaponized her strength against her, claiming her step-by-step recall was too perfect and too cinematic to be real. They entirely missed the biological reality. Her hyper-focused clarity wasn't a script, it was a profound survival mechanism. The profound irony of the case is that the exact analytical genius that made her count invaluable was the very reason the system initially dismissed her. But science doesn't care about behavioral stereotypes. It cares about data. It wasn't until a detective bypassed the institutional bias and actually tested her metrics against reality that the entire investigation locked into place. First, because her blindfold had been slightly loose at the bottom, Lisa caught glimpses of the car's interior. She noted a distinct digital clock layout, a deep maroon carpet, and a white dashboard emblazoned with the word Magnum. She also gave them the precise timestamp of that ATM stop. Investigators pulled local bank telemetry from that exact window of time. Only one person had used that machine at that timestamp with a card registered to a 1978 Dodge Magnum, Bobby Joe Long. When detectives impounded the vehicle, the interior specs matched Lisa's data point for data point. Second, the FBI crime lab had been tracking a single microscopic variable found on every single body in the Tampa area. Rare red lustrous nylon carpet fibers. Once the Dodge Magnum was in custody, forensic technicians performed vacuum sweepings of the interior. Under the microscope, the factory carpet fibers from Long's car matched the trace evidence from the victim pool with 100% chemical and physical consistency. Finally, the task force raided Long's apartment. Latent print examiners went straight to the bathroom surfaces Lisa had specified. They lifted her exact prints from the porcelain and the mirrors, legally demolishing any potential "was it me?" defense. The hard forensics validated her trauma when human empathy failed. Because Lisa McVeigh treated her mind as a forensic tool, a prolific serial killer was completely nailed within 2 weeks of her abduction. Her trajectory after staring down a monster is the ultimate testament to her analytical mindset. She didn't just become a victim advocate, she put herself through the police academy. She spent over 20 years as a master deputy for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, specializing in sex crimes and protecting children. Our minds may not be flawless hard drives, but when an observer is hypervigilant, human observation becomes an invaluable beacon. It shows investigators exactly where to focus the lens, so that the hard laboratory science can build the bridge to justice. At the end of the day, when we step back and look at the entire landscape of criminal justice, the truth becomes undeniably clear. The human mind is a beautiful, fragile, and volatile thing. It is capable of the most brilliant feats of survival telemetry, as we saw with Lisa McVeigh. And it is simultaneously vulnerable to the most subtle forms of contamination, as we saw in a crowded psychology classroom or a high-pressure police lineup. Our minds are simply not pristine hard drives. They change, they adapt, and they rewrite their own data to help us survive the chaos of life. And that is exactly why the legal system has to change the way it treats the human voice. We have to stop treating eyewitness testimony as an absolute anchor, something heavy and immovable that we tie an entire case to, hoping it holds under the weight of a trial. When we do that, when we rely on compliance and confidence instead of proof, the house of cards inevitably collapses and innocent people pay the price. Instead, we have to start treating human memory as a beacon. A beacon doesn't build the bridge for you. It doesn't give you the final answer. What it does is shine a sharp, bright light into the darkness and tell you exactly where to point the lens. It gives you a direction. It generates a lead. Once that light shows you where to look, you bring in the laboratory mindset. You deploy the digital telemetry, the microscopic trace evidence analysis, the latent print examinations, and the unyielding laws of physics and chemistry. You let the objective data do the heavy lifting. If the science backs up the story, you have a solid foundation for justice. If the science contradicts the memory, you follow the data, no matter where it leads or whose feelings it hurts. Because in a courtroom, a confident story can be a dangerous illusion, but the science never lies. As we wrap up today's look into the volatility of human memory and the psychological noise of the lineup, we are officially moving forward into the next phase of our multi-part systemic audit, the Innocence Project. Next week, we shift from cognitive failures to laboratory solutions. We'll break down the evolution of DNA testing and look at how objective molecular data is weaponized to overturn wrongful convictions. So, if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the mechanics of memory fascinating, please take a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community. I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come learn along with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I will see you in the next episode.